Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. It was on October 19th in 1987 that global markets would experience what would be termed as Black Monday. This was when the Dow Jones Industrial Average Index fell 22.6% in a single trading session, the largest one-day percentage decline in that index's history. I'm Jimmy Moyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the governance concerns that continue to plague the Public Investment Corporation. We speak to Karuska Consulting's Kaya Sithole around that and get a sense of how it is that those challenges could potentially be navigated. We have a conversation with the team at First National Bank, taking a look at their Retirements Insights survey that they released today. We're going to speak to the head of product at F&B Wealth and Investments and get a sense of what some of those key retirement insights look like. We also have a conversation with the counselor at ICASA, taking a look at the digital infrastructure regulations that had been promulgated and proposed in the past. These regulations have gone through a written submission session, an oral submission session that concluded this week, and we're going to reflect on some of the findings thereof. Then we have a conversation with the team at Standard Bank, taking a look at how it is that women play various roles in wealth building, not just as home builders, but also as custodians of wealth and transferers of wealth at that. We wrap up the show with a small business conversation. We speak to the founder and CEO of First Principles Engineering and get a sense of that business and why it was made.
The day's markets, understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
As always, that's where we kick off the show, with a sense of market movements that took place throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by independent analyst Terence Hove to take a look at markets and see if we can make sense of them. Terence, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks for the time. A red day on most of the equity markets. We managed to somehow carve out 4 basis points of gains on the all share, even if the top 40 did finish ever so slightly in the red. But a bit of an up and down day, and it seems as though that up and down momentum and cycle continues within the markets.
Yeah, good evening, Jimmy. Good to be here on the show. And when we look at that sea of red, as you've mentioned, in the market, we're seeing that sentiment that's actually stalking up. And what's interesting, you know, driving that sentiment, that risk-off sentiment, is, you know, the geopolitical tensions between the U.S. and Iran. Sell-off in the technology and semiconductor space. I mean, there have been growing concerns there with regards to the capital expenditure. You know, when we look at the cloud computing infrastructure, when we look at the R&D, but in particular that cloud and infrastructure, that spend, and the concern that, you know, is this not going to cut into margins, you know, amidst the ongoing, you know, Q2 corporate earnings, when we look at it, you know, on the U.S. side. But, you know, the main theme really being the geopolitical tensions between the U.S. and Iran. And a few weeks ago when we spoke, you know, there was a positive hurrah around the peace deal, the interim peace deal that had been signed, and, you know, the momentary truce that was in place. However, when we now look at, you know, that flare-up, and I think even at that time, when we had the conversation, when we're looking at the risks of this geopolitical tension and how quickly it could flare up. And that's now stalked, you know, global inflation concerns. And that's, you know, tempering investor sentiment. And that's what we're seeing, you know, weighing on the market, you know, in terms of that sentiment driver, in terms of that trade, in terms of investment, investor sentiment, and yeah, where the next investment is going to go.
Terence, speaking of that investor sentiment, at the moment, investors have quite a bit to contend with. They're dealing with factors that you've alluded to around some of the global developments. But at the same time, we're seeing that markets like the gold price start to, what we'd think be attractive, apparently not as attractive as what we'd expect with all of the risk sentiment that is sitting out there. Where is the value being found in the markets at the moment? The rand is a bit weaker. The cryptocurrencies aren't doing too much on their part. Where do investors start to look when times are as volatile as these?
Yeah, I think from that point that you mentioned, you mentioned that the rand is slightly weaker. It's not significantly weaker. The rand is faring considerably well given the geopolitical risks. And being an emerging market, where it's sitting, it's really holding, with that 16 handle. So it also speaks to when we look at South Africa as a destination, some of the locally dominant corporates are outweighing, for example, the commodity driven exporters, on that pricing. You've mentioned gold now. It's softer. The concern there, it's that inflation concern that's really outweighing that that risk that is in that geopolitical risk in the market. So the thought would be with the geopolitical risk flaring up, gold is a safe haven asset. You'd see increased flows there. There's still flow going into gold, but perhaps not as significant in terms of that price jump, because that pressure is coming from, this global inflation concerns. And that is what's weighing in on the commodity price as well. However, when you also look at the pricing, it's still, quite significant to where gold was. If we look at, going into 2026 alone. So, when you look at that mix of, your resources, but when you also look at, in shares linked to the South African economy, they've maintained an upward trajectory. And, and the resilience is also being supported by, steady corporate updates. You've got Hadako reporting, quite a significant jump in their interim turnover, over 7%. So when you look at South Africa as a destination, in those entities that are operating, within the South African economy, I think you're seeing those pockets of value.
There might be some pockets of value that continue to exist in the market. They might be a bit difficult to find, but markets are still trying to make heads and tails of what it is that is out there from an information perspective. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Independent analyst Terence Hove joining us to take a look at markets and try and make sense of them.
What does retirement really look like in South Africa today? It's more than a number in a bank account. It's freedom, security, purpose, and peace of mind. FNB is bringing retirement planning to life through art. They've launched the Retirement Reality Gallery, an immersive exhibition inspired by the 2026 FNB Retirement Insight Survey. From rising living costs and healthcare concerns to legacy and financial independence, explore the realities shaping retirement through the eyes of some of South Africa's leading artists. Visit the FNB Retirement Reality Gallery at Goodman Gallery, Rosebank, from this Thursday, 16th to 19th July, and experience the story behind statistics. Best of all, entry is free. Brought to you by FNB.
Time. When you're a kid, it moves slower than a sloth trying to get through airport security. There is just so much of it. Skip forward a few years to your 20s. Time is still your friend. It says have some balance. Go party and have fun. Then your 30s hit. And time suddenly steps on the accelerator like it's trying to catch a traffic light before it goes red. 40s. Now time is moving faster than your 10-year-old on a sugar high. 50. You're desperately trying to save as much as you can, but time is moving so fast. And all you can think is, where did all the time go? That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money, and then money gives you more time for some much-deserved you time. Now, isn't that a compelling enough reason to invest? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This interview is brought to you by FNB. So earlier today at the Goodman Gallery here in Johannesburg, the team at FNB provided us with their Retirement Insights Survey results. This is the fourth year that they have been running this particular survey and providing the market with their insights. We're going to be taking a look at these findings in a bit more detail with the head of product at FNB Wealth and Investments, Sam Gelozwane. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Sam, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Give us an overview of the particular survey that you run and what it was intended to achieve when it was initially launched 4 years ago.
Thank you. Hello to all the listeners out there and hello to you. The survey is called the FNB Retirement Insight Survey. This is our fourth, edition of the survey. And what we try to achieve with this survey is to actually unpack the retirement readiness of South Africans. We're basically testing, are South Africans saving for retirement? Are they actually having the right tools where they're saving for retirement? We are actually checking on their confidence with regards to the plans that they're actually making, when it comes to retirement planning. And that is basically with regards to those that have not yet retired. But for those that have retired, with the survey, we check whether they actually, how are they experiencing retirement, is it in line with their expectations or things that are different from what they were expecting, and also just to find out if they were actually had to go back 20 years or 30 years earlier, what type of lessons, what type of things would they have done differently in regards to retirement planning and retirement saving. That's what we're trying to look for with regards to the survey, and then in terms of unpacking the survey, it then helps us to understand people, how they engage with retirement, and also gives us, tools that can help us to actually enable people to retire better and improve their confidence scores as they're saving for retirement.
Sam, let's get into some of the insights from this year's survey. What did we focus on and what did we learn about the retirement readiness of South Africans?
Thank you. I think that's a great question. And maybe I'll split it up, in terms of engaging with regards to the statistics that we actually unpacked on the survey. Maybe let's look at the under 60s. What we see there is that about, three quarters of the people that are actually saving for retirement, they have retirement annuities, which are basically the structured retirement savings products that we expect them to have as they're saving for retirement. However, the interesting part around it is that most of them are not confident around, their retirement readiness. And this speaks to the fact that they're probably not aware in terms of, are they saving sufficiently on these particular products for retirement? Do they have the right underlying solutions as they are saving for retirement and all that? So that's basically what we're unpacking with regards to those that are under 60. And then we looked at the barriers for those that are actually do not have, retirement, solutions or are not making plans. They're highlighting a number of barriers. So we see that 53% do not have, this retirement plans. And they're saying, my barriers is actually the fact that I believe that I do not have sufficient money for me to save towards retirement. Others are saying, as much as I do not probably have money to save, I think the state is going to take care of me. So those are the barriers that they are highlighting. Cost of living is coming out, strongly with regards to people, saving for retirement. And we are actually seeing those that are actually approaching retirement, and we are seeing that most of them are actually not planning on retiring, you know, fully, you know, about 72% of those in the private segment market. Just to highlight to you, private segment market is usually starting around about people who are having a household income of above, you know, 750,000 per annum. And it's a very small portion of the population in there. And they are able to actually have the liberty of extending because they have not saved sufficiently. And so they plan on actually extending, you know, their working life. But those that are in the personal segment, which is the majority of South Africans, as much as they do not actually have not saved sufficiently for retirement, they kind of do not have options around continuing. So we're seeing that most of them are talking about actually taking up a side hustle, second profession, so that they can supplement, you know, their retirement income. So that's what we are actually seeing with those that are actually approaching retirement. And then with those that are actually in retirement, we see that they also have a struggle when it comes to cost of living and how this cost of living is actually impacting their, you know, their retirement. We see a majority of the people are struggling with that, both on the personal as well as the private segment. And when we actually unpack as well with those that are in retirement, they're actually saying that, you know, 60% of them are saying, listen, if I paid off debt earlier, I think I was going to be in a better retirement position. And we see about 30% of those in the personal segment who are actually going into retirement with some debt, you know, and then those are the challenges that people are actually highlighting when it comes to their retirement.
Sam, when it comes to retirement, a significant portion of South Africans are having to go through things like extra income opportunities, side hustles, as you alluded to, because the cost of living is so significantly high and a lot of people can't actually afford to retire. If we are to look at that as perhaps the starting point for improvements, what should South Africans be doing today to improve their chances of achieving their retirement goals before they retire?
Thank you. That's a great question. And it's quite pertinent in that we are actually picking up the struggle with regards to cost of living being higher than expected to such an extent that some people are actually, you know, close to about 14% that dropping off, you know, having private medical care. That is those who actually have private medical care, and then they actually rely on the public system. So we're actually putting strain on regards to the public system. You know, some of them are cutting back on holidays, they're downsizing on houses and all that. So what we actually advocate in terms of, you know, trying to actually prepare for retirement is to have a holistic retirement plan. Start early having that particular plan and be able to actually set up structures which will enable you to save properly for retirement. So what we see is that people are saving for retirement, they get disturbed by emergencies whilst they are saving. So we're saying if you have a proper plan, you probably have money that is set aside for emergencies, you're actually reducing your debt on a monthly basis, or you're having structured debt that is actually slightly different and less, you know, costly. You have some policies that are going to cover you in the event of when life happens. So you've got all those things. Once you have all those things, that does enables you to have a much more stable retirement plan. You do not get disturbed, and you are able to actually have a proper plan, and you can stick with the plan over a long period of time.
Planning for retirement is something that is essential and something that everybody needs to be focusing on, regardless of where in your retirement planning journey you are. The latest FNB Retirement Insights survey suggesting that South Africans need to improve their retirement readiness if they are to retire comfortably. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Head of Product at FNB Wealth and Investments, Samukelo Zwane, joining us to reflect on the Retirement Insights survey that FNB has been putting together for the last 4 years. This interview was brought to you by FNB, the FNB Retirement Reality Gallery, where insight meets experience.
What does retirement really look like in South Africa today? It's more than a number in a bank account. It's freedom, security, purpose, and peace of mind. FNB is bringing retirement planning to life through art. They've launched the Retirement Reality Gallery, an immersive exhibition inspired by the 2026 FNB Retirement Insights Survey. From rising living costs and healthcare concerns to legacy and financial independence, explore the realities shaping retirement through the eyes of some of South Africa's leading artists. Visit the FNB Retirement Reality Gallery at Goodman Gallery, Rosebank, from this Thursday, 16th to 19th July, and experience the story behind statistics. Best of all, entry is free. Brought to you by FNB.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
In the last 137 days, the Public Investment Corporation has gone through some significant challenges. The Chief Investment Officer of the business parted ways with the PIC by mutual agreement. The Chief Executive Officer has been placed on suspension. The Interim Chief Investment Officer has since been replaced, and two non-executive directors have since resigned. To top that all off, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority has announced that they will be launching an investigation into the Public Investment Corporation. We're going to be taking a look at this and trying to make sense of these developments with the founder and director at Kariska Consulting, Kaya Sithole. He joins me on the line now to see if we can understand this. Kaya, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. What seems to be happening at the PIC beyond the conversations you and I have had around the institution?
So what seems to be happening is that it's yet another installment of the governance crisis that seems to be a permanent feature of the PIC. Now, a couple of years ago, that is eventually led to an entire commission of inquiry that was really focused on trying to understand exactly what is it that keeps going wrong when it comes to the governance processes of the PIC. That particular commission came up with recommendations, and the PIC went through some sense of stability in that they had a CEO who actually started and completed his term. And we thought that they essentially understood what it takes to govern an entity of this nature. Unfortunately, since then, it's all yet again fallen apart. The CEO who replaced Abel Sithole, that is Mr. Dlamini, is now the one who's been suspended on the basis, apparently, of a whistleblower report that says he has done something wrong. But before we got there, there was indeed the dismissal of the chief investment officer, who also hadn't been there for too long. There was then the interim CIO, and that interim CIO has now also been removed. So it sounds like it's just yet another episode of what happens to be a very frequent, far too frequent occurrence at the PIC, where for some reason or the other, those that have the responsibility of managing its affairs simply either do not understand what it takes to do, or they have far too many conflicts and far too many hostile entanglements that make it very difficult for them to really smoothly run this operation.
Speaking of individuals that have to make the relevant decisions related to this, we reached out to National Treasury to get comment on these developments, given that National Treasury is the key stakeholder in this case, and the chairman of the PIC's board would also coincidentally be the Deputy Minister of Finance, Dr. David Masondo. National Treasury has confirmed to us that they're not speaking at this stage. Kaya, I want to get your thoughts on National Treasury's position in this particular context, given that we also seem to be hearing rumours that the Deputy Minister and the Minister himself might be sitting on opposite ends of the table where it relates to this asset manager in particular.
Well, the first part is obviously the issue of what relationship National Treasury has with the PIC. So what the PIC's model says is that obviously it has a board of directors, and the ANC government has decided that the chair of the board must be the deputy finance minister of the time, which is really something that a lot of people would express reservations about. The Mbati Commission particularly expressed reservations about that. But be that as it may, they are the government of the day, and they've decided that the answer is that the chairperson of the board must be the minister of finance. But what also happens is that there is then the question of, well, beyond the board, there is always a shareholder. And in this instance, the shareholder is the National Treasury itself, but it is now represented by the finance minister himself. So the question of whether the two political principles get along is an important one, because if there isn't a meeting of the minds between the minister and the deputy finance minister, it simply means that there isn't a meeting of the minds between the principal shareholder and the chair of the board of directors. And you can imagine what the consequences of that divergence would be for any organization, and in particular for an organization as important as this one. The fact that they're not talking is not helping, because obviously if they are not talking, it means they're either still deliberating on the issue, or they have taken the view that if anyone talks, it will simply alienate or, you know, deepen the divides ideologically or otherwise between the two principles. And it's perhaps in their best interest at this point in time to say as little as possible. But that clearly is not in the best interest of the PIC, which is why even the Financial Sector Conduct Authority has said, well, we actually now want to be able to activate our ability to ask direct questions about what on earth is going on?
Kaya, speaking of things that are in the best interests, I want to look at the best interests of the beneficiaries of the 3.6 trillion rand that the PIC is the custodian of, and that is of course the public, mainly the government employees, a pension fund that represents the hard-working civil servants of South Africa. At what point do we start to ask the question of placing the Public Investment Corporation under administration? Would that do anything to solve the problem and the challenges around governance that present the organization?
No, of course not. The thing about administration in relation to governance in South Africa is that at least the politicians' understanding of administration is that rather than have an entire board of overseers, you appoint one person who's got unilateral powers to take all the decisions. You've seen it happening at the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, and you've seen it happening in other government structures. It is clearly a dangerous model, because you can imagine that for any company to have only one person being the rule and the law unto themselves is dangerous. For an entity like the PIC, where 3.6 trillion rand is the number that gets bandied about, because that's just one proxy of how big they are in the terms of the assets that they own, the idea that one person could have unilateral authority to do absolutely everything is quite simply untenable. The PIC's solution is to find a governance model that enables those that have the executive roles to be able to do their jobs, and those that have the governance oversight roles to be able to exercise oversight in a manner that enables the institution to progress. The idea of administration, it sounds, you know, attractive to politicians, but it actually doesn't get us anywhere.
Kaya, what are the risks that confront the Public Investment Corporation at this stage if these ongoing governance challenges continue to persist? 3.6 trillion rand, as we've rightly mentioned, is no small figure, and it means the livelihoods of a lot of South Africans. What are the risks here if these governance challenges are not addressed?
Well, the primary risk is the risk of paralysis, because the way the PIC is that the PIC gets given money by the Government Employees Pension Fund in particular, and other smaller funds. And the primary responsibility, and in fact, the exclusive responsibility, is to make sure that those funds grow. Now, the way to grow funds is not to keep them in a bank account, because we now know how low the savings returns are in South Africa if you simply put money to sit idle in a bank account. So the answer is to take that money and invest it into projects, into, you know, ideas that will enable it to grow. So when you have an institution that doesn't have a chief investment officer and a chief executive officer, the type of decisions that are necessary on the deployment of funds, on the question of what to invest in, when to invest and how much to invest, those decisions ultimately get delayed and deferred. So it simply means that the primary reason for the PIC to exist, in other words, to invest money and grow money, that is the thing that then ends up not happening. So that is as paralyzing and as dangerous as it can be.
Certainly, a lot of questions are being asked of the Public Investment Corporation, questions we have put forward as well, and we're looking to speak to the Standing Committee on Finance in Parliament on the 4th of August or after then, because that is when they will be summoning the Public Investment Corporation to a committee meeting to ask their own questions. Hopefully, some of the questions we've looked at here could be addressed there. We'll see how that conversation unfolds. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Founder and Director at Kariska Consulting, Kaya Sithole, joining us to shed some insights on the governance challenges that plague the Public Investment Corporation.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
What does retirement really look like in South Africa today? It's more than a number in a bank account. It's freedom, security, purpose, and peace of mind. FNB is bringing retirement planning to life through art. They've launched the Retirement Reality Gallery, an immersive exhibition inspired by the 2026 FNB Retirement Insight Survey. From rising living costs and healthcare concerns to legacy and financial independence, explore the realities shaping retirement through the eyes of some of South Africa's leading artists. Visit the FNB Retirement Reality Gallery at Goodman Gallery, Rosebank, from this Thursday, 16th to 19th July, and experience the story behind statistics. Best of all, entry is free. brought to you by FNB.
The Independent Communications Authority of South Africa, ICASA, concluded their round of hearings around a draft regulation that they previously put out for commentary. We're going to be taking a look at this as it relates to the treatment of digital assets and infrastructure by municipalities, amongst other institutions and organizations. I'm joined on the line by Councillor at the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa, Medikeledi Mushi, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Mushi, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Can we start with an overview of the draft regulations that were presented to the public for comment? What was the intention behind putting those draft regulations forward?
Thank you for having ICASA. Good evening to SAFM listeners. The main purpose was to give effect to Section 21 of the Electronic Communications Act, which basically deals with ICASA making regulations for that would facilitate the rapid deployment of broadband infrastructure in South Africa. So the main purpose was to provide regulations that spell out processes and procedures for obtaining permits, authorization, and any qualification for access to land, mainly for the purposes of deploying broadband infrastructure in South Africa. I'll just put it high level. There are some subsets, but the crux of it is for just to streamline processes and procedures. And let me maybe just add and clarify that the regulations are in truly so directed at licensees, as ICASA can only regulate its own licensees and no one else outside of the ECA framework.
Mushi, can we take a look at the consultations that have taken place? There was written submissions. We know that this week we've just concluded oral submissions in response to this draft policy. Can you give us some insight around what was brought to the table? What were some of the concerns, perhaps some of the insights that came out of these oral representations and the written representations?
All right. Two or three steps back. So when the minister issued the policy directions that required ICASA to consider drafting these regulations, we then called a mini workshop with key stakeholders. And we call them key stakeholders as in persons that are directly affected, you know, or are actively involved in infrastructure layout. These are your MNOs, your Digital Council Africa, which is the association. So your wireless access providers, your ISPs. And we had a conversation and we asked, what are the challenges to you guys rolling out infrastructure in South Africa? And within the Section 21, what can ICASA do to facilitate access and to deal with complaints largely that are around the Wayleaf process that is not streamlined? It does not have certain deadlines, timelines, and related charges. And that conversation was followed up with ICASA doing its benchmark study that also informed how we should draft the regulations. And with that, then we drafted the regulations. And these regulations were looking at how do we then try and address the concerns, but still within ICASA's mandate. And I'm emphasizing that because what came out very strongly in the, so we got then written submissions and then we followed up with the oral hearing so that we can, you know, be given an opportunity to ask clarity-seeking questions emanating from the written submissions. And it came out very clear that the concerns are that, one, there are so many municipalities that you apply to as a licensee, you don't know whether the Wayleaf application process is going to take 2 days, 3 days, a month, and how much is you're going to be charged, as there are different frameworks for every municipality. And that impacts the timelines, you know, rollout timelines. It also impacts on the cost to deploy infrastructure. We had those complaints, and that is what now we try to address in the regulations. And it is very important to say, how far can we go? And ICASA can only go as far as its legal mandate. So part of the conversation that we had in the 2 days was to interrogate the people that made written representation to say, how would you then expect ICASA to regulate, extend its mandate to now issue instructions that are over in our language could be seen as overreaching, because municipalities have got their own municipal act that, you know, directs them, and they've got the legal authority to run their own business the way they do. So the conversation came out very clear that the regulations are not addressing the core of the problem, but the core of the problem is what does not sit within ICASA's legal mandate. So we are at that point right now. And our view as ICASA is that we view the regulations to have at least given our licensees processes and procedures to follow when they want to access land, when they damage someone's land. You know, we've provided for a compensation framework. We've provided for a resolution dispute framework. And to the extent that we are then saying, at least let us know that our licensees know to go consult with local communities where they want to deploy. Because amongst the complaints was that some local communities don't open up when they, you know, they reach out. But the legal mandate of ICASA directs us in terms of how we then have this conversation.
May Mushi, also from a mandate perspective, mean that ICASA would then be able to make recommendations to the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies on your findings and perhaps what it is that needs to be addressed that falls outside of ICASA's scope?
Yes, certainly. We would have to then go back to our principals and just as a policy advisor, you know, ICASA is an independent organ. We've got regulation making powers, and we are given those powers by the ICASA Act, and we are given direction within the ECA to say, how can you make these regulations? Now, what is the problem that we have also identified is that even our Section 21, I think to a certain extent, has obligated ICASA to go beyond its scope. So we would have to then go back and see how we balance the what is in the legislation, which is also espoused in the policy, and take the conversation back to say, Minister, we need a broader conversation on this matter. And the broader conversation means we need to then have COCTA in the room, SALGA in the room, and let us not also limit this conversation just to municipalities, because part of the authorization process includes, for example, the South Africa Civil Civil Aviation Authority for environmental issues. So it's not just municipalities, but all related players where licensees have to go and knock on their doors to ask for permission to enter to deploy their networks.
Mayor Mushi, before I let you go, I want to take a look at licensees and service providers in particular. There's been a concern expressed from the service providers, at least some of them, that there is a slow rate of approvals where it relates to obtaining approvals from the relevant municipalities. And I want to get your thoughts around perhaps how that could be addressed and whether or not some of the complexities that exist there might be something that ICASA could intervene on.
As I said, we know what our limits are. And my anticipation is that we should have a collaborative effort at it where, you know, it's not through regulation, but rather through a collaborative forum of some sort where we then come into the room and say, municipalities, this is a national government objective that we are busy with. And we are all, you know, organs of government that we've got to come work together. But this cannot be done through regulation. There is no way that ICASA can start to even impose timelines on municipalities or CAA, as I said. But we can maybe try and negotiate and see how they can be streamlined. And let me just touch on something that's interesting also, that there is some standard draft bylaws that were issued by COCTA. The standard draft bylaws were meant to be adopted, especially by apparently smaller municipalities, to try and streamline their processes. We heard amongst the people that were in the room, City of Cape Town, that said, we don't even have not adopted those standard bylaws because we've got our own process. Now, there is that challenge also that even COCTA cannot enforce these standard draft bylaws. Now, this is now saying the problem is way bigger than ICASA. But as the regulator, my inclination is that we need to have a collaboration of some sort, a memorandum of understanding or agreement of some sort to try and co-regulate, but not through ICASA's regulations.
Digital infrastructure certainly needs all hands on deck, especially if we are to have various stakeholders involved in its rollout. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Dikeledi Mushi, councillor at the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa, reflecting on the round of oral submissions related to the draft regulations on digital infrastructure and its relation to municipalities.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by the Standard Bank Group. The investment landscape is certainly changing, and more specifically than that, the high net worth investment landscape is changing with different decisions being made where it relates to wealth. And at the center of these decisions and these changes is the women of our country. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the head of high net worth investments at Standard Bank South Africa, Thandi Ngwane. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Thandi, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. We've seen over perhaps the last decade or more, the conversations have been shifting around how it is that we're approaching investment, wealth creation, wealth preservation. And it is a little known fact, but central to these, women do tend to make better investors than men.
Thank you so much, Jimmy. It's lovely to be joining you. And yes, absolutely. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. Traditionally, we have seen that women tend to show more measured risk appetite. And this isn't necessarily through being more risk averse, but I think it's really just about managing investments a little more strategically. It's about being more risk aware, I'd say. And often this is what leads to women often outperforming. It's really through disciplined long-term approaches, as opposed to trying to time the market and be a little more speculative in trading. So what we have seen is women increasingly, we know that they lead households, they make a lot of the investment choices. More and more so, they're also becoming the architects of philanthropy structures and succession planning. And so I think what it certainly does show is just how women are starting to dismantle the old narrative that investing is purely about aggressive risk-taking and short-term goals.
Speaking of those old narratives, Thandi, I want to take a look at perhaps some of the traditional assumptions that we've had around investing and how those assumptions could have potentially negatively impacted the conversations that need to be had around investing. I mean, typically we do see that risk taking is perhaps quite the topic of contention as to who takes more risk between men and women. But how do some of these traditional assumptions that we've had around investing potentially influence or keep investors away from making investment decisions?
I think it really all comes down to investor behavior. And I think there have been many studies that have actually been conducted that have showed the difference between, you know, investor behavior and investment behavior. And it really just speaks to the whole concept of staying invested in the market, it's time in the market as opposed to timing the market. But I think as we start to talk about this massive shift of assets globally from baby boomers to their heirs, the conversation, as you point out, has changed, particularly around women and wealth and how they are starting to drive that narrative. And what we've seen is that, you know, the narrative is starting to narrow. You know, previously we had seen a lot of talk around women and finances, and the rhetoric was really around inequality, financial literacy and access. Whereas now reports are telling us that women now control a growing share of global assets. So discussions about women and wealth have also become far more candid. You know, we're hearing more around subjects on funding barriers and women when it comes to entrepreneurs in particular. And more women are also, we can see, they're extending their earning runway, their investment horizons, and are increasingly confident in just managing their finances.
Managing finances is one thing, Tandi. I want to take a look at wealth creation, wealth preservation, and even wealth transfer. The data suggests that even in these areas, as we start to see a shift in how it is that we're reading the investment landscape and the roles and responsibilities within the investment landscape, that these sorts of areas become areas where women really excel, especially if given the opportunity to properly map out investment decisions.
Yes, absolutely. And I think even if you look at the advisory landscape, and if you speak to financial advisors who are advising women in particular, we're starting to see that the models built around patriarchal succession and pure return maximization and the like are no longer enough. So advisors in this space are certainly seeing the need to reflect dynamic, more multi-generational wealth structures that now start to balance financial performance and sustainability. So you mentioned the likes of wealth preservation, for instance. Yes, absolutely. I think just that ability of being a little more risk aware and thinking about diversification quite differently in the context of sustainability as well is where I think the way women think about wealth management and financial planning is quite different to what we've seen traditionally.
Tandi, before I let you go, what is the biggest misconception around being a woman in investing, whether it's as a high net worth individual, as a client, as somebody managing portfolios? What is the biggest myth or misconception that needs to be debunked right now before we even get into Women's Month?
I think it's the fact that women take a backseat when it comes to their financial plans and to investments in general. We certainly have seen a big shift, certainly in the last 10 years at least, of women really taking the forefront when it comes to their own personal finances, but also in the world of asset management. If you look at some of the portfolio managers, the fund managers who are making key decisions in terms of asset allocation, you are also seeing an increased number of women taking the lead there as well.
I happen to think that women have been in the investment landscape longer than we care to give them credit for. It is only that we're only now starting to acknowledge their presence because it is becoming increasingly undeniable. And that is what is reshaping the fundamentals of how it is that we're approaching investments and wealth creation. We're going to have to leave the conversation on that note. Head of High Net Worth Investments at Standard Bank, Tandi Ngwane, joining us to take a look at building generational wealth and the role that women play in that. This feature was brought to you by the Standard Bank Group.
Sure, it's great knowing my net worth's denominated in dollars, euros, pounds, and rands. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. This is surprising my bro in the States on his birthday.
Surprise! It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get an offshore account with 4 currency options and pay no monthly maintenance fees. Search Standard Bank Private for more. Standard Bank, it can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
SME of the Week is powered by Capitec Business Banking. Start out or scale up with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply. It is SME of the Week time. We love showcasing businesses that are doing exceptionally well for themselves and sharing those businesses with you, our SAFM community. This week's small business is a company called First Principles Engineering. Any guesses as to what they do before the founder of the business lets us in on some of those insights? I'm joined on the line by that founder and chief executive officer of the business, Tsakane Zwane, to take a look at her business and get to know it a little bit better. Tsakane, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. A very on-the-nose name. Tell us about First Principles Engineering. What brought that about?
Hi, Jimmy, and good evening to your listeners. Thank you for having us on the show. So First Principles Engineering is basically an innovative solutions company that provides practical engineering solutions. So we have combined our experience in project management, manufacturing, operations, construction, to bring solutions, value to our clients. And that's basically what we do. We apply the principles of First Principles, where we break down complex systems into their building blocks and solve the problems at its root cause through its building blocks and understand where the problem is so that we are able to create value and we are able to create lasting solutions for our clients, things that are customized and create value.
Tsakane, why did you build this business?
That's a very interesting question. So when I was growing up, I've always been a top achiever, and I was told that, you know what, you're good in maths and science, go do engineering, you'll be fine, you'll get employment. And I did that. And I became an executive, and that was great. But it didn't fulfill this desire that I had in my heart to make a difference and create lasting impact in our country. And that only came about when I did MBA, where my worldview was opened up, and there and there, it hit me that 9 to 5 was great for me, but it wasn't great for this deep desire that I have to solve our real issues and to create lasting value. So then I ventured into entrepreneurship, and it's been interesting, to say the least, Jimmy.
Entrepreneurship certainly is interesting, especially in the South African context of what it is that we go through as South Africans with our unemployment rate and all the other factors. Tsakane, tell me about how it is that you structured your service offering. You touched on being able to offer a range of services, being able to provide solutions to clients. But I also know that from a business perspective, there's quite a clear focus that you have on uplifting the underserved rural communities and townships in South Africa. How does that fit into your overall plan from a business perspective?
Yes, definitely. So from a business perspective, we offer two offerings. The first one is Innovative Solutions, which is one of the projects that I'll talk about shortly. And the other one is Infrastructure and Project Management. So my partner and I have realized that our core competency lies in project delivery, mine mostly in the public sector in South Africa. He's mostly in the mining across Africa. He's been in over 10 countries in Africa. So we have combined that to say that we will offer solutions, because we understand that the world is evolving. We need to constantly innovate, but also we will look at our core competences, which is project delivery in the sectors that I've mentioned, and that is also our offering. So
it's important to look at what it is that you bring to the market and build a business around that. That's certainly what the founder and CEO at First Principles Engineering, Tsakane Zwane, has done with her business. All the best to you and your business, Tsakane. We love to see your business doing well, and we look forward to seeing it continue to grow. That's where we're going to leave the conversation. Our SME of the week this week is a company called First Principles Engineering. Inspired by the SME of the week? Start your own business or scale up and save up to 50% on fees with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're running a business, you know this sound. That's growth. Another customer. Money in the bank. Why should your business slow down for your bank? With Capitec Business, it doesn't. You get lower fees, faster credit approvals, and bankers who know your business. Now that's progress. Bank on better with Capitec Business Banking. Capitec is an authorized credit provider, FSP 46669. Initiation, service fees, and conditions apply.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the update for the show, folks. That's also the update for the week. If you've missed any of our conversations, remember they are made available as podcasts for you to catch up on. As we wrap up the week, we're wrapping up the week with the gold price just dipping below $4,000 a fine ounce. I wonder what seems to be happening there, given that the oil price is still very much above the $80 a barrel level. We'll look at these and other factors next week. For now, it is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Host is standing by with the latest round of evening news. He will, of course, be followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. So from my side, good night.